Well, it's great to be with you this afternoon. We've got 20 minutes to get through this. I can assure you that we made, Dave and I worked all week to try to get him here, and you know, sickness is something that's out of your control, but just so you know, in front of everyone publicly, Dave did do his best to get here, but pneumonia got the best of him. So thanks to the empire of Skype, we're able to communicate today. It's a little bit, you know, unnerving to have your former undergrad professors in the audience as you present. I was just thinking that it's actually 10 years to this day, or 10 years to this week, that I was finishing up papers for Ted Grimsrud and Ray Gingrich, who are here, for an Anabaptist history and witness class, or Anabaptist history and theology, and then a history of philosophy of nonviolence class, I believe. On the one hand, it's unnerving. On the other hand, they're complicit in my formation. And Ted has at least agreed that anything that I say that is particularly hurtful or frustrating to you, that he is open for counseling. I have his email address. I know where he lives. He will treat you to coffee. You can talk through the various points. So the title of our presentation is Empire is a Frontier of Mission. While empire has long been neglected by many involved in the Christian mission enterprise, both by practitioners and thinkers alike, and the reasons for that neglect can be the subject of a discussion later, Dave and I are making the claim that empire today, particularly in its American incarnation, is an important frontier for missiology to critically engage, and consequently for those concerned about the mission of the church, all of which have implications for the church's identity, the church's self-critical reflection, the church's engagement with the world and powers that be, etc. Of course, there's a little bit of a twist of irony in talking about mission and empire, because we know throughout history that mission and empire have been in many ways coterminous and synonymous. But today we're trying to sort of flip that on its head and look at it from another direction. What we would like to do is start with a missiological concept that helps frame our discussion, and then outline three case studies of people that we have come to know, people who are so-called new Anabaptists, who have found their way to Anabaptism through its missionary wing. And here, J.R.'s presentation earlier kind of lays the foundation for that in some ways in talking about his own journey towards Anabaptism and the role that Wilbert Schenck played. So Anabaptism through its missionary wing, with one of the key resulting expressions of their journey being church plants. And these church plants, in different ways, critique empire in their given specific context. So first, the concept of frontiers. Now, in missiology, there are plenty of frameworks and diagrams to understand what's God doing in the world, how do we understand mission, and so forth. But one of the more helpful ones that we have come across is Wilbert Schenck's understanding of changing frontiers, or his concept of frontier. So the concept of frontier first indicates where the crucial engagement is taking place, whatever that engagement may be. Second, a frontier indicates barriers and boundaries that must be crossed in order to carry out any given missionary task. So the pursuit of the frontier signals an obligation to outward movement, change and transformation away from the long-held stereotypes, and movement towards new opportunities, new challenges, and new growth. This concept of frontier is particularly important in a new era when the geographical frontier of the modern missionary movement is no longer operative. So missiologically, according to Schenck, the challenge of the future is to continually discern the ongoing changes in our cultural landscape so as to challenge the existing forms and patterns, and in turn create new ones to fit existing realities. So I won't really go through this entire diagram, but there really should be arrows going from each of the circles in to the center, and then arrows from the center out. So for example, if you were going to say that child trafficking was a missiological issue, you could look to these three arenas to help shape how one would think about child trafficking being a missiological issue. Likewise, you could look to these three areas and ask certain types of questions, and perhaps come to the conclusion that children at risk, or child trafficking, is a missiological issue. What we're saying is that empire is one of the changing frontiers of mission, and that empire needs to be addressed as a missiological issue. That surely has been the case for a long time, but we're saying probably more so than ever. How are we defining empire? Empire, we're going to do the sort of the 30,000 foot view of empire. Empire is in some ways synonymous with American Christianity. And as soon as I say American Christianity, I'm going to take it back because no such thing exists. There's no such thing as American Christianity. Last year, the International Bulletin of Missionary Research counted 37,000 denominations, many of whom have headquarters in the United States. So there is no such thing, not only to mention that Christianity in the U.S. is shaped perhaps more so than in any other country by various waves of immigration, and so that the religious influences, the religious practices, the religious ideas that we have in this country are in some ways shaped from forces outside the country more so than they are inside the country. That's certainly true historically. So perhaps we could talk about Christianity in America and its collusion or intermingling and weddedness with the economic, political, cultural, and military powers of the day. So that's sort of, I think, what we're gonna stick with. We could at least make the claim that to be Christian in America is to be intrinsically tied and linked with the central processes of globalization, of which many more are losers probably in our world than winners. The flip side of sort of this big, bad, beast-like empire, of course, are many empires. And so here I would at least like to suggest that if the Christendom Project was an incarnation of empire and that its long shadow or a kind of hangover still exists today, then it is also true that a mini-empire called mini-Mennonite Christendom also exists. Mini-Mennonite Christendom probably shares many of the same kinds of characteristics as its bigger, badder counterpart, including a territorial mentality, cultural provincialism, theological strongholds, and centers of power, just to name a few things. So we're kind of toying with two kinds of empire. So our modest proposal that we want to sort of flesh out is that a faithful witness to empire takes its shape in a missionary ecclesiology. And this is an academic, we don't have the time to go through, you know, and flesh out exactly what a missionary ecclesiology is, talk at length about what empire is or what faithful witness is, but what we'd like to do is offer people that we know that embody this in some way and maybe point to how this exists in three different places. So Dave is actually going to walk us through the case studies. We can bring Dave. Dave, do you hear me?
I kind of hear you.
Well, you're up now. Were you able to track at all?
Somewhat. It sounded very smart to me.
Well, I just set you up to talk about the case studies.
Okay. So it's my turn?
It's your turn.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm glad to be there in this way, at least. I'm glad I didn't come. I still feel a little bit bad, but much better. And I feel that there was value in not bringing the plague to the Eastern Seaboard. Like Matt's been talking, we're concerned about mission and definitely concerned about empire. And it's been a fun challenge to kind of really figure out what we really think about that and in preparing for this presentation. And again, I wish I could be there. It would have been fun to be part of that energy and that conversation there. But in preparing for this, I was just thinking back about through some of the marks of the church throughout history, and it just struck me in how the church has often had to engage with empire, and especially from the beginning in the first century. I mean, right away, the crucible of empire gave shape to the identity of the church and the mission of the church and the context of the church. As Anabaptists, we can look back at also the 16th century and see how Christendom also was a crucible in some ways for giving identity and call to a church and trying to figure out how it was supposed to engage that context of the time. So as American Christians today, we're also, I think, confronted by empire in a different way. And in some ways, it's kind of an in-between, maybe between the Roman Empire and the Christendom of the past. In some ways, it's not as clear. But in some ways, we're also still trying to find our calling and identity today. What we're trying to point out today is a faithful response to empire really begins with a missionary posture or a missionary posture of the church. And I've had the privilege of meeting numerous people over the past number of years in California that have really come to value or identify with Anabaptism. And it's been interesting to see how they are, for lack of a better word, contextualizing that in their different areas of work. So I'm going to start with Tommy. He is a high school teacher in Orange County, and he comes from a background in conservative evangelical Christianity. He has been on a journey over the past number of years of really finding meaning in Anabaptism, and he actually came to Fuller Seminary to explore that further. He and his wife have been involved in church plants for a number of years now and have been experimenting with new forms of church and really engaging that evangelical Christianity of Orange County. I'm going to read the slide that should be up there. I had a conversion experience from American Empire conservative evangelicalism to becoming an Anabaptist who now won't say the Pledge of Allegiance in front of my kids in the classroom, because I pledge allegiance to something else. It is no longer equated with being an American. I think this is a good entry point into why mission is important for engaging empire. Christianity is about a lot of the identity we have in Christ and about confessing Christ as Lord. And that is similar to, I think, the first century where Christians really had to define that in that similar way. So Tommy, he is not Mennonite, but he calls himself Anabaptist and sees himself creating new Anabaptist communities in Orange County. And the fact he says that their vocation is really to converting conservative evangelicals to what they think is a more authentic way of being Christian. So they're trying to put Anabaptism into practice in their experiments of house churches. I think it offers a distinctive alternative and when it comes to the church structure or leadership in the church. It's more egalitarian or consensus-driven. For them, simple living and thinking justly about money has a real relevance in a part of the country where materialism and consumerism is quite celebrated, if you know anything about Orange County. So for him, you know, Anabaptism represents one of those streams in Christianity that's a minority report to the Christian church and to empire. I'm going to move on to Sue and Hyun. Hyun is Korean by background, and Sue is Korean-American. And they're both church planters in the Los Angeles area. They started a church a number of years ago called The Church for Others, and this year they're launching their second church plant. And it's a mission that they have to reach out to the Korean immigrant experience. They see Anabaptism as offering really a chance for renewal and mission to the Korean context, because they've seen the Korean Christianity go through some real profound changes when it comes to nominalism and the growth of individualism, and really the cloud that surrounds the Korean experience today, which is still that conflict between North and South. So Anabaptism offers a lot of answers to what a lot of Korean Christians are asking these days, or at least that's where they're coming from on this. So I'm going to read the slide that should be up there. Our desire is to live out the Anabaptist vision of discipleship, community, and peacemaking in our immigrant church context. And we believe that these core values can be best expressed in our missional context through the practice of hospitality as a community. We find commonality with the early Anabaptists who sought refuge from persecution and who cared for families of martyrs. We can identify with the struggle of displacement and the need to depend on the hospitality of neighbors to survive in the immigrant experience. Now, for them, they have, you know, maybe a different encounter with empire, and that's through the experience of being immigrants. But they're, again, they're engaging and trying to form new communities of the kingdom, basically, that represents something different that's not only relevant to their Korean experience, but also to that immigrant's experience here in the U.S. Now I'm going to go to Jason. He's the last guy we have here to profile. And Jason's a bivocational church planter in San Diego from Methodist, Baptist background. And he came through Anabaptism really through his exposure of reading John Howard Yoder and other Anabaptist writers. For Jason, the 9/11 experience was one that was quite pivotal. and especially when it came to questions about his own faith and violence. And for him, as he looked around, it's harder for him to realize, you know, don't we as Christians, are we not resembling the one who we claim? And so for him, 9/11 was a real demonstration of the tragedy of violence. I'm going to read a quote from him. It's not up on the screen. "I think living in post 9/11 world, we have learned of the failure of violence via power. Any strong conviction, absent of any prohibition against violence, is utterly tragic. We have seen that within nations of prominence, wealth, and power, we have reduced our actions to violence against nations of no power and no wealth. I think everybody saying gets the violence just doesn't work. There is a stream of Christianity that has always said that this is not the way of the cross, and that is just beautiful to me." Again, he's engaging in a context in San Diego that's profoundly shaped. I mean, many of the people he works with don't have Christian background. And some of the major issues that he's engaged with has to do with the border there, because San Diego's right on the other side of the border of Tijuana, and that's something he's deeply passionate about. I'm going to read the slide now as a way to transition into my final points here. Creative ways to not simply sustain but to thrive are often found at the margins. It never comes easy and most often requires significant sacrifice. As Anabaptists, we have within us the DNA to sustain hard times. I'm convinced that some of us as Christian immigrants to an Anabaptism are discovering many of those ancient ways. And as we do, perhaps our discoveries can be of value to the broader Anabaptist faith community as we together seek how both to survive and thrive in the years ahead. I think from all three of them, we see them deeply committed to engaging the context where they're called, and they're trying to transform it in new ways, and they're doing that by the formation of new communities. I think all of them believe that the formation of new communities, especially of peacemakers, disciples of Christ, ones seeking out to live out the kingdom, really makes a difference. They want to see new communities that come together that embody the values of the kingdom and that witness to these things that also embody what empire is, like consumerism or individualism or the valorization of power, success, and might. And to me, that is beautiful. I think what I'm also impressed by is how they're responding to empire. And as Jason there at the end talks about how what it means to survive and thrive to the future is that I think when we go about mission, we're going to find many new partners of what it means to engage the empire, and especially through the mutual interest in mission. I'm reminded of when I worked in peace activism in Germany. I lived there from 2002 to 2006 and was heavily involved in the peace movement there. I was working for an organization called the Military Counseling Network, and we worked with U.S. soldiers who were resisting the war or were conscientious objectors. And I remember going to, you know, dozens and dozens of meetings and protests and rallies, and I would look around, and over time you get a sense that this is the same people are showing up. And I did this for years, and it just seemed like it was always, you know, the same kinds of people or the same groups of people that were showing up to these things. And I think that that's a little bit now, speaking as a Mennonite, where we find ourselves in at this kind of crossroads where for many years it's been the same people showing up to this conversation about the kingdom or engaging empire or even peace theology. And what I think is unique time is that we're going to find many new partners in especially when we start thinking missionally of engaging empire in our culture. It's not only a time just to survive but to thrive. So I think that starts with realizing that empire is our mission field, and that we need to recover our role as missionaries in the empire. The early church occupied empire by seeking the kingdom. The early Anabaptists occupied Christendom by seeking the kingdom. So to occupy the American empire today, we as Christians need to seek the kingdom and invite others to seek with us. I'm going to quote Tommy, the first guy I talked about. He talks about, "The kingdom is not only an inner or future reality. It is instead the primary allegiance for disciples now and at every level of our existence, personal, social, economic, and political." So to me, announcing the kingdom really is a proclamation, and we're called to do that, to proclaim the kingdom, but it's also a proclamation of allegiance. And we need to remember that it's also an invitation to new allegiance. And so for me, what I'm captivated by is this idea that we're, as missionaries in the empire, really begins this whole journey of bringing other people into new allegiance with Christ. I'm done.
Well, I know, I don't know how much time we have. We have one minute. Well, I hope that gives you some insight. What we wanted to do was methodologically use some people that we know, new Anabaptists who are claiming a Mennonite identity in some way, who conceive of themselves as missionaries who've come to Anabaptism through sort of its missionary stream or its missionary wing. And who are forming communities, church plants, that in and of themselves are practicing certain types of religious practices, and are witnessing to the empire given their particular context, whether it be Orange County, San Diego, or Korea. So hopefully that gets us going with a little bit of a discussion. I know time's out. Thanks, Dave.
I also might say quickly that I'm aware that I'm a white male, PhD trained, ivory tower, inclined to abstraction, and church bureaucrat. So in all the chants of damn the man, it probably points at me as the embodied representative. Also, let me just say quickly that I'm an Anabaptist at home, kind of the opposite of Chris, an Anabaptist at home in the Catholic sources. In my PhD work and in some of the examples I'll draw out, I think you'll see this, that I'm at home in a time when the Anabaptists think the church went the way of the toilet. So now that I've totally blown away any kind of expectations you have of me, even sworn and used potty humor in the Christian Holy Land of the Shenandoah Valley, still I want to turn to my argument then. So I think the Anabaptist traditions, neo and otherwise, are rightly but slowly turning to the corporate practices of daily prayer as a means of tactical resistance, and I'll say what that means in a bit, within the bonds of empire. So the hours of prayer then, as I'll argue, are ascetic and tactical practices, which are loaded terms, which we'll get to, offer a unique counter to empire. Rather than occupying a place, these liturgies make use of time, resisting its commodification by the global economy. What is more, by giving physical voice to the alternate imaginary, the liturgical assembly is subtly shaped into persons desiring the strategies of God. This ascesis, then, not only transforms those at prayer, but also brings about a new mode of social interaction outside the capitalistic hegemony. It's a lot of words, a lot of big words. So what do we mean by this thing that we call empire, this thing that we have in our title? Just what is it that we seek to occupy? Though this assessment is overtly Marxist in dealing with the production and capitalist production of the multitude, Michael Hart and Antonio Negri offer a helpful description of empire. In general terms, they say that empire is the new context for geopolitics. No longer can we think of the world events in terms of nation states and intentional sovereign actors. Instead, we must attend, they argue, to the ways economics, and specifically global capitalism, defines the workings of the world. Markets, exchange, production, accumulation are now the mode of the world. And as they note, and, as they note, are totalizing in their capacity to consume all space. It breaches national boundaries, subsuming material and labor in the constant quest for accumulation. So here we could turn to a quick example of the Greek debt crisis, wherein the global economy, through the auspices of the European Union, imposed new leadership on a democratic republic. This simply said that the wider economic frame was more important than their democratic process of selecting leaders. So as the sitting government tried to offer referendums on the new leadership, the global economy said any bailout of the Greek nation is contingent upon placement of certain authoritarian rulers. So in sum, empire won the day in that context. In the words of late 20th century politicians, it's simply the economy, stupid. For Hart and Negri, this is the reality of empire. They say, quote, the primary factors of production and exchange, money, technology, people, and goods, move with increasing ease across national boundaries. Hence, the nation-state has less and less power to regulate those flows and impose its authority over the economy. End quote. The economy in the terms of production, consumption, and accumulation is subsumed formally under capital. In these terms, capital must cross boundaries in the quest for new resources and new labor. It consumes the world, totalizing governments and personal subjectivity within these categories, that is, of capital, production, means, and wealth. The new empire negates the modern understandings of governance as social contract and replaces them with economic practices. Laws that once were justified as a means for ensuring freedom and the greatest common good are now evaluated on economic grounds. What is more, human personhood is described as each one's ability to both produce and consume. Thus, exchange dominates every mode of thought. Of course, the break between the modern statecraft and the understanding of empire isn't as clean as we'd like it. Much of the language used is still that of Hobbes, Rousseau, and Jefferson. That is to say that now life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness are cast as the accumulation of wealth, goods, and production in capital. Yet even these democratic values are understood as the results of appropriate exchange within a capitalist system. When goods and currency flow through the systems of the empire, the greatest good is achieved. Hence, we get the argument in the Greek debt crisis that the global economy can say to the Greek people, it is not your life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness that matter, but those of the greatest good. The problem with this is that there is no longer a proper place for influence. In the modern nation state, we could point to places such as New York City, Washington, D.C., Geneva, or even London as the centers of power. Empire, however, decentralizes all systems, creating what Hart and Negri call the non-place. In effect, the interactions between traditional actors no longer occur in places of power. Rather, empire works in a network system, passing both wealth and influence through multiple nodes to many actors. For Hart and Negri, this can be best described as the concept of oligopoly, a large economy based on an infinite number of points of contact. A television broadcast or the internet best exemplify such an oligopoly. There is a unique and relatively fixed point of emission, they say, but the points of reception are potentially infinite and territorially indefinite. Unquote. The nodal points in the global capitalism, however, are many. So, as in a large media conglomerate, there is an entity that produces, yet even the organization is dispersed around the world. These nodes in the network gather power and wealth through an increasing number of connections that intersect the node. In true capitalist fashion, the more connections, the better, such that an oligopolistic model is not a rhizome, they say, but a tree structure that subordinates all of the branches to the central root, although we still can't point to a central root because it's delocalized. The effect, as we have seen in the Congressional Budget Office report and made manifest in the Occupy movement, is that capital is gathered in the hands of the few, the 1%. Unfortunately for the Occupy movement, there is really no place to rightly occupy. There are centers within this system, but in practice there's no single proper space. The 99% then must find ways to inhabit the globe. For the neo-Marxist Hartin Negri, this means a proletariat resistance centered on the economic terms of the empire. But I think they are right in saying that in their concluding chapter, the new imperialism in this network allows for greater confrontation without the need for mediation. Hence the frequent statement of the revolution will be not or will be televised. People can speak and act in ways that challenge the larger nodes directly. The viral nature of the Occupy movement is making this clear. The larger media moguls are no longer needed to publicize the resistance. The effect is a kind of fissure in the system, places where people can gather and subvert that system which seeks to conquer all places. Here's where I turn to a place and no place. Many theorists have presented a history of the desert monastic movement, that it became a new locus of Christian asceticism. Some have said that the increasing wealth and status of the Roman Christians, coupled with the imperial recognition of Christianity by Constantine, sent Christians on a quest for more demanding practices of the faith, basically that the monastic life was a replacement for martyrdom. Others have argued that the driving impulse was an economic and political rather than theological. This thesis states that many of the new ascetics were basically fleeing taxes and the law. Asceticism in this frame is more a life on the lam rather than any kind of quest for virtue. Of course, these arguments are not mutually exclusive. They do, however, point to the common context that they shared, namely that there is an escape from the place of empire. Belden Lane, in his Thiessen lectures, helpfully discusses this geography of withdrawal and thus resistance to empire. He says, quote, "It fascinates me how in the scriptures God is always leading God's people into the desert and up the mountain, taking them to the edge, to a liminal place where the ordinary things fall apart," unquote. Place then plays a key role in the scriptural narratives, wherein Jacob's vision of the heavenly ladder, the piling of stones made for significant encounters with God, and even the desert wanderings and covenant in Sinai all point to the fact that Yahweh brings God's people into a place. Often that location is outside the centers of power and wealth, and as Lane notes, the cultural center, thus leaving the people of God without the trappings and defenses so cherished in the organized society. We could turn then also to the example of Jesus entering the desert, where Henry Nouwen notes that there the temptations come. He says, quote, "The compulsions of the world to be relevant, that is to turn stones into loaves, to be spectacular, that is to throw ourselves down, and to be powerful," thus the statement, "I will give you all these kingdoms." In the quiet of the wilderness, alone and hungry, Jesus is confronted by all the values of the world, of the empire. It's in that place, however, that presents both the dangers of the temptations and the opportunities to seek to see the empire stripped of its trappings, that is, for what it really is. Empire tries its best to keep us distracted from those desert experiences, thus its consuming of all places. Time and money are organized so that the mind and heart never have the opportunity to see the world in the light of its contingency in God. The desert retreat of Jesus and the later Abbas and Ammas are formative practices of resistance. Being in the wilderness allows for the distractions to fall apart before our eyes. For it is there on the edge of the utter abandonment of risk and unknowing, that is where you are certain that you are going to fall, that's where you leap into the arms of God, says Belden Lane. In more contemplative dimensions of Christianity, the desert place is where one confronts the false self in an effort to find one's true self. In an age such as ours, when identity is just one more facet of consumerism, this kind of place away is essential. Unfortunately, empire is built on feeding identities as a means of sustaining the market. False selves are erected with each commercial and billboard. Even our church communities are marked by identities, encouraging people to church shop for the community that most represents them. The result is a consumeristic approach to discipleship, more akin to the facades of the empire. So where then do we go if the lines between church and the ever-expanding empire are vanishing? Where are the desert wildernesses wherein we can leap into the arms of God? That's just it. There really isn't a place to go. As Hart and Negri argue about the capitalist roots, the boundary places are continuously consumed in the course of expanding markets. In the quest for more labor, more resources, and more wealth, the desert space has been assumed within the totality of the market. It's as if there is a consistent refrain in the din of the global marketplace: you can run, but you can't hide. Graham Ward, in his book, The Politics of Discipleship, uses an interesting example to illustrate the inescapability of the imperial structures, one that might strike us as odd or familiar. The Amish, he says, are highlighted as a prime example of withdrawal from the surrounding culture, for they live in, quote, splendid isolation. However, they still require the sale of their produce in the outside world in order to survive. The markets are simply inescapable. I think this should echo for us in our ears the Psalms, which sound eerily familiar, especially 139. Where can I go from your spirit, or where can I flee from your presence? In the days of Babylon and Assyria and Rome, the reigns of the empire had clear bounds. So to talk of God as one who transcends the limits of political and geographical space was an act of resistance. Now in the days when the political economy of empire encompasses everything, it's easier to identify its divine attributes. That is, empire is the ultimate idol, supplanting the very divinity of God. For it is in empire that we, quote, live, move, and have our being. Or as Ward states in the imperial myth, the traditional attributes of God are made material: omnipresence, omniscience, and omnipotence. I'm not sure that the Occupy movement has fully grasped the omnipresence of empire. Inherent in the very nature of the movement is this ideology of place. The Occupy motif assumes that there is still some exterior-interior dynamic in the imperial context. Yet as we've seen in the articulations of Hart, Negri, and Ward and these early desert and the early desert monks, there isn't really much place to flee. Empire is everywhere. The logic of the Occupy movement has assumed that resistance is best practiced by carving out a place within an empire, by making space for egalitarian conversation and the sharing of goods in a public space. The imperial fortresses are somehow subverted. But I think, as we've seen in all the news reporting, however, even the public square is colonized. The systems of empire tolerate such actions only for a period of time, but soon economic criteria are leveraged to justify the eviction of the occupiers. Not long after the movement set up in city centers, businesses began complaining of the economic impact of barricades and decreased patronage. Finally, city executives dispersed the occupiers, arguing that the needed presence of police and sanitation crews would soon require more capital than the cities could afford. These categories and values of the imperial market quickly eroded the very logic of place, removing the resistance just as the body's antibodies expel a contagion. Tolerance had reached its limits. This is where I want to turn to philosopher Michel de Certeau, who talks about the difference between strategies and tactics. You might have encountered it in the beginning of Hauerwas's The After Christendom. He just mentions it briefly. The distinction that de Certeau highlights is that institutions operate in what he calls a strategic mode, that is, having a proper place to they circumscribe a place that has an exterior and interior, making a proper place for action. Tactics, on the other hand, don't assume the logic of place, but assume the logic of time. Thus, a tactic is something that is a ruse or occurs on the wing, as Desserteaux notes. That it is takes the goods of the society, its place, its language, its modes of action, and subverts them through episodic action within time. Here, Desserteaux highlights the image of a city, right? So that you can look over the top of the city and see the city planner's motif. You can see how they've designed the sidewalks and the roads to encourage the best flow of traffic, and they insert values in that way. The pedestrian, on the other hand, doesn't look at it from that perspective, but operates on their own logic, whether that's expediency, whether that's to see someone else, to attend to a particular park. So they don't move through the normal strategic traffic patterns, but subvert it. It's interesting here that the tactician or the pedestrian acts within the presence of a system or an institution in order to make manifest another way, however fleeting it may exist. Since it's in time, it can come and go. By outlining the tactical practices, Desserteaux reveals another form of resistance. Rather than adopt the strategic posture of empire, specifically the proprietary place, tactics provide the church the ability to resist empire as it waits for the fulfillment of the kingdom of God. Tactics make plain the ways in which the lived experience of persons resists being reduced to more manifestations of the Foucauldian grid of discipline, which constructs society. And that's coming from Fritz Bauerschmidt up at Loyola. Discussing the nature of stories as a tactical tool, Bauerschmidt notes that the narratives function as a bridge that opens the inside to the other. In order to skip, as everybody else has had to do, we'll look at this quick conversation about ascetic practices in time. When we consider the practices of daily prayer, particularly of praying the Psalms, we have before us a kind of practice that's ascetic in nature, that is to say that there are practices which are engaged in within a dominant frame which inaugurate new understandings of the self, new social imaginaries, and new ways of interaction. So then, what is this asceticism that we're talking about in the hours of prayer? We can see there that... let me go back to this. That daily prayer offers a new imaginary, particularly gathered around the language of the Psalms. That these, as Brueggemann says, the Psalms offer a counter-empire, one that reveals the contingency, the fear, the anxiety, and replaces them, not necessarily replaces them, but counters with the language of abundance, sufficiency, and God's continued care and grace. When the church begins to engage in these practices of prayer, the imperial strategy is subverted, even for just a moment, through the proclamation and embodiment of a community at prayer. As the empire seeks to commodify time, people can engage in their own practices within time, thus subverting the very strategic implications and desires of the empire. In the face of empire, the Psalms proclaim the sufficiency in God, the missio dei, without dismissing the anxiety and fear. Rather, the prayerful recitation of the text proclaims fidelity, abundance, and mutuality. Or, as we could look at the work of Jamie Smith, as he notes in Desiring the Kingdom, the liturgy of the Psalms shapes the desires of people to seek first the kingdom of God.
Okay, as Brian said, I'm a senior at EMU, and I'm going to be presenting my sort of the research I did for my history thesis as part of that senior project. But before I begin, I want to acknowledge that Paul Peachy and Cal Redicop have joined us here today. Paul and Cal were both a part of the original Concern Group meeting in 1952 that I'll be talking about. So we're grateful for your presence. Thank you. And another thing before I begin, I think one way to think of my presentation is as a kind of historical case study for a lot of the themes that we've been working with in the last day, including church organization, structure, issues with the ministry, training, professionalization, that kind of thing. So I won't make those connections explicit, but those things can sort of come out in conversations later. So to begin. In February of 1946, half a year after his graduation from Eastern Mennonite School and his marriage to Ellen Elizabeth Schenck, Paul Peachy sailed for Europe after feeling a strong sense of personal call to work with Mennonite Central Committee. There he joined a growing number of Mennonites doing graduate studies, mission work, or relief project administration. With the ruins of Christendom visible in every war-ravaged direction, newly discovered sources on 16th century Anabaptism to explore, and important theologians to study with, it was an exciting time and place to be a Mennonite. In the fall of 1951, Paul Peachy sent out a letter to six other Mennonites studying or working in Europe. In that letter, Peachy suggested the idea of a study conference in Amsterdam on Dutch Mennonite history, combined with a roundtable among the participants. After several months of correspondence, seven Mennonite men, and they were all men, David Schenck, Orly Schwarzentruber, John Miller, Paul Peachy, Irvin Horst, and John Howard Yoder, and Cal Redicop, showed up in Amsterdam on April 15, 1952. I don't think it was intentional, but this conference has been scheduled just a day before the 60th anniversary of that original meeting. Out of that first meeting came steady correspondences between the seven, several more meetings, first in Europe, then back in the United States, and ultimately the publication of Concern, a pamphlet series, which published 18 issues between 1954 and 1971, and this is what a typical example of that looked like, just for your interest. What anchored all of these writings were two interrelated frustrations. First, Concern members criticized the centralization of authority in church organizations by which just a few powerful leaders wielded power inflexibly and unilaterally. Second, and more broadly, Concern criticized the institutional and cultural forms those powerful leaders and previous generations were building up, a critique that included arguments against not only the ethnic boundary markers of Mennonite society, but also the professionalization of the ministry, the development of denominational structures, and the perceived assimilation that accompanied that development on issues of economics and non-resistance. Particularly in Paul Peachy's writings, this critique of institutional and cultural forms grew out of an unflinching emphasis on the local congregation that modeled itself after the New Testament and Anabaptist examples in a way that was unmediated by continuing cultural forms and institutions. While Concern's first critique, that was sort of the first thesis, and here's the second one, while Concern's first critique of centralized authority took hold in Mennonite society, and the powerful leaders who had guided Mennonites through World War II consequently passed away without replacement, the second, more general critique of institutional patterns did not result in either a significant transfer of power or a shift in emphasis to the local congregation. In fact, while the Mennonite church has shifted away from highly centralized leadership, partly in response to Concern's critiques, that very response has actually strengthened the pace of bureaucratic institutionalization in the Mennonite church. Power was devolved from centralized leadership not to congregations, but to broad institutional structures. Some background. Almost all of the seven men originally involved had been formatively shaped by the collection of powerful and visionary leaders in the Mennonite church during the interwar and post-war periods. Foremost among these leaders, as I'm sure many of you know, was Harold S. Bender, who was dean at Goshen College and Goshen Biblical Seminary, who helped found the Mennonite, and along with him, Ori Miller, who helped found the Mennonite Central Committee in 1920. This generation of leaders pioneered what Paul Taves, a Mennonite Brethren historian, called an ideological and sociological recovery. Schools were strengthened, relief organizations, seminaries, and community associations were founded, denominational structures were formalized, and Harold Bender almost single-handedly brought Anabaptist scholarship into the realm of respectability. Bender himself summed all this up in a triumphant exhortation on the first page of the first issue of the Mennonite Quarterly Review, which he founded in 1927. Bender stated, The coming generation in the Mennonite church is being given a carefully built, well-knit, efficient organization of activities. The faith has been kept. Unquote. However, this gift of an efficient organization and its administration by a few powerful leaders did not please the members of Concern nearly as much as Bender expected. The first of Concern's critiques, directed toward centralized power, sprang directly from the Concern members' experiences with MCC in Europe, even before their 1952 Amsterdam meeting. In a letter from John Howard Yoder to Paul Peachey in February of 52, Yoder indicated that he wanted to discuss strategies for publicly airing their, quote, broader questions of administrative policy, and suggested that, quote, each of us prepare for Amsterdam a list of theses summarizing the constructive criticism we want to get across. Peachey agreed and noted to Urban Horst in a letter a few days later, quote, the question of over-centralization in MCC involving top decisions made too far from actual facts on the field has arisen again, unquote. The Concern group found their leaders unresponsive to these concerns. When Peachey wrote to Bender on behalf of the seven participants at the Amsterdam conference, urging him to consider having open communion at the World Conference in Basel that summer, Bender rejected the idea outright. No conversation on the issue. Similarly, Yoder stated very tellingly, after Peachey had apparently found a welcome reception from MCC leaders in the U.S., quote, I'm not at all surprised that MCC is friendly to you. Since Ori Miller doesn't take anyone's criticism seriously as criticism or advice, he could hardly take it seriously as offense, unquote. In Concern's view, the old guard lacked the capacity for flexible, responsive leadership. More broadly, Concern members quickly aired increasingly general criticisms of the institutional structures being built up by the Bender generation. At the end of their original 1952 conference, David Shank produced a summary of the conclusions, and John Howard Yoder also separately compiled his own thoughts in a document that would come to be known as The Cooking of the Anabaptist Goose. The main theme of both responses was the fear that American Mennonites, precisely because of their institution building, were assimilating to American culture. This included the way colleges were run and the fact that even mission boards lend money at interest, a practice which would have sent Blaurock or Reidemann through the roof. That's from Yoder. David Shank's notes argued that the fact, quote, that there is a corpus Mennonitarum over and beyond a corpus Christi, which is the center of life and witness, is the heart of our contemporary problem. This is the mini-Mennonite Christendom that was mentioned earlier, I think. Even further, however, what troubled Concern members about Mennonite institution building was not only that it insidiously promoted forms of assimilation, but also that it distracted from and even hindered the immediate gathering of Christians in the local congregation, which for Concern constituted the church. In the second issue of Concern in 1955, Paul Peachey's essay, Spirit and Form in the Church of Christ, named this decisively, contrasting the spirit of the early church gathered together praising God and celebrating its diverse God-given gifts with the forms that always work to stifle that creative reality. After noting this problem in Catholicism and Protestantism, Peachey stated that, quote, by the same token, we must reject the contemporary American Mennonite assumption that the overarching denominational organization, together with uniformly binding cultural traits, is constitutive of the church. The greatest tragedy of all, he said, is to be found in those groups who had recaptured the New Testament concept and have become Catholic in the course of time, unquote. The core of the Concern critique formed around this notion of the primacy of the local congregation acting in response to the Spirit on the model of the New Testament church. Speaking from this place, Concern members would challenge a variety of developments in the Mennonite world. One widespread theme was Concern's fear about the professionalization of the ministry, in which pastors, rather than arising organically out of their congregations, were trained in central locations and then dispersed to fill a standardized role in diverse congregations. In an unpublished manuscript from the 1950s titled, Do We Want a Professional Ministry?, Peachey indicated that the trend toward the full-time monarchical pastor indicated again that, quote, our church life and method of work reflect too largely the methods and value systems of Western civilization, unquote. He stated, quote, the primary focal point of spirit manifestation in the New Testament concept is the bosom of the church community, where the two or three are gathered, and not the boards of directors or trustees remote in space and even in time, who determine courses to be taken by the masses. What we need is not more salaried theologians, but more farmers, bricklayers, clerks, teachers, and homemakers who are trained in the truth of the gospel, unquote. Along these lines, the Concern group also celebrated the emerging house church movement, particularly in the 1958 issue of Concern, which was given over entirely to the subject. More specifically, two house church, church groups were formed fairly directly as a result of concern, a congregation in Philadelphia and Reba Place in Illinois, which many of you are probably familiar with. Though there was some tension among the seven concerned members about the founding of these new institutions. All these critiques were shaped by the European experience of the concerned members. In Europe, Paul Peachey and the other members of Concern were forced to think about Anabaptism in a setting devoid of the American Mennonite social forms. Paul Peachey's dissertation on the primarily urban origin of Swiss Anabaptists provided an imaginative space for re-envisioning Anabaptist life beyond isolated rural communities. Additionally, the apparent failure of many European Mennonite groups to maintain their Anabaptism made Concern highly sensitive to assimilationist tendencies in American Mennonites. All this took place in a bombed-out landscape, a constant reminder of the failure of Western civilization and the increasingly meaningless trappings of Western Christendom. So what has happened since then? The world that Concern critiqued has changed. The powerful centralized leadership of men like Bender and Miller, to which the Concern critique was mainly directed, no longer exists. Yet the institutional forms that Yoder, Peachey, and others critiqued so earnestly have persisted. In fact, in the last 50 years, responses to Concern's critique of centralized authority have actually strengthened bureaucratic and institutional structures in the Mennonite Church. The Mennonite Church, 60 years after the original Amsterdam meeting, is no longer dominated by just a few powerful men steering all of the major church institutions. In terms of broad trends, sociologist and current provost of EMU, Fred Niss, noted that given the increasing number of Mennonite seminary and college graduates since Bender and Miller's time, it was simply, quote, unlikely, given all the competition, that any one or two people could concentrate control, unquote. This is also simply a function of maturing institutions. In addition to broader trends, though, Concern's influence has contributed directly to a reduction in centralized power. This is most concisely noted by a reference to the process of curriculum review known as the Dean Seminar, undertaken in the 1960s at the Associated Mennonite Biblical Seminaries, AMBS. In 1997, Rodney Sawatsky, then president of Messiah College and previously of Conrad Grebel, wrote an article arguing that leadership in the Mennonite Church had been handicapped by a, quote, anti-leadership, anti-authority, and anti-power mythology that he traced to the influence of the Concern Group and particular interpretations of the priesthood of all believers concept, which found expression in the Dean Seminar. Theologian William Claussen, who published several articles in the Concern series and took part in the Dean Seminar, wrote a response to Sawatsky's essay. Claussen argued that the Dean Seminar was, in fact, a crucial moment for AMBS and the Mennonite Church, and that it positively redefined leadership, but in terms of committees and group processes. Claussen stressed, quote, by its very format, the Dean Seminar was a model of good leadership. The Dean was clearly the leader, but not as one who imposed his views or convictions on us or on the conclusions. It was a genuine group process involving not only extensive consultation with all faculty and staff, but also with board members and a broad constituency concerned about the direction of the church. Unquote. For Claussen, the legitimacy of the process lay ultimately in its resembling the group processes contained in the New Testament. Just as Concern had emphasized the authority of the local congregation's deliberation over the authority of a pastor, so Claussen argued for the superiority of bureaucratic deliberation over centralized unilateral leadership, although he didn't state it in those terms. There are several other examples of this phenomenon, including most notably the study conference on church organization begun in 1955, by which the Mennonite Church was decentralized somewhat, with more responsibility devolved to regional structures of conferences. In addition to the contribution Concern's critiques had on the bureaucratization and broadening of leadership in church institutions, it has been those very institutions that have, in turn, sustained the Concern critique and their articulation of Anabaptist identity within the Mennonite Church. The Dean Seminar at AMBS has already been noted. Many Concern members spent large parts of their lives training pastors or other students in Mennonite institutions, most prominently Yoder, Miller, and Redekop. Concern's critiques were largely expressed through, not in spite of, the very institutions they opposed. Perhaps an exception, Peachey taught for a few years at EMC upon his return from Europe, but consciously later chose not to be involved in Mennonite institutions and instead taught sociology at Catholic University for the bulk of his career. More broadly, Concern's influence has been spread much more by trained Mennonite clergy than through Mennonite laity, an irony taken up eagerly by Gerald Schlabach in his book Unlearning Protestantism, which Chris mentioned last night. While concern has had some effect in broadening the leadership class in Mennonite institutions, the fundamental issue with institutions identified by concern, namely that they tend to operate in terms of power, not in terms of the New Testament example, as they would put it, is as pressing as it ever was. For Yoder and Peachey especially, institutions were troubling because they tended to confuse the identity of the church with organizations that had to operate on the principles of management specific to their required tasks. And this complaint is still operative today. What does it mean for a nursing home or an insurance company to be distinctly Anabaptist? Everence, the name of a Mennonite, the new name of Mennonite Mutual Aid, the insurance company with origins in the Mennonite community movement, is an interesting case in point. Recently, Everence was the very first insurance company targeted under the Affordable Care Act for unreasonable rate increases. Everence claimed that the discrepancy was the result of a different methodology than that used by the Justice Department accountants, and that its rate rises were justified by widespread rises in medical costs. Regardless of how this argument pans out, the salient point here is that the merits of Everence conduct are now determined, in conversations in the broader world at least, by the accepted rules of the insurance industry in relation to government regulations, rather than by the New Testament in relation to the church, as concern might say. This is the fundamental issue that confronts every church institution, whether it's a school, relief agency, publication, or denominational leadership structure. Members of concern faced up to a generation that had given them, in the words of Harold S. Bender, a carefully built, well-knit, efficient organization of activities. Yet concern challenged the very notion of the value of such a gift, criticizing most fundamentally the institutional forms that constituted the gift, as well as the leadership style that thought it possible to simply impart such an organization. In his memoir, A Usable Past, Paul Peachey asked quite open-endedly, quote, "To what extent can Christian ecclesias become embodied as materially based cultural institutions without jeopardizing their pneumatic integrity or their spirit-filled integrity?" Standing in the midst of the ruins of Christendom in the 1950s, concern's answer was very little. The answer of today's Mennonite church in word and much more in substance has been significantly more. This question of balancing cultural and institutional continuity with the pneumatic, spirit-filled integrity of the local congregation is fundamental to the experience of the church. Every generation must answer it afresh.